is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Happy Martin Luther King Day. And if you live in Alabama, Arkansas, or Mississippi, it's also Happy Robert E. Lee Day. And in fact, I understand in Virginia, it's the Robert E. Lee weekend. Louise and I went to see Selma over the weekend, and as we go through the program, by the way, at about 20 after this hour, Reverend D. Alexander Bullock will be with us to talk about Dr. King's legacy. And at the top of the next hour, Dr. Clarence Lussain is going to be with us in the same general topic. But the question that strikes me is, how do we fulfill Dr. Martin Luther King's dream? How do we do that? You know, the movie Selma. First of all, I want to talk about the movie Selma. This is a movie that every American should see. And if you have not seen this movie, make a special effort to get out and see it this week. This is an amazing piece of movie making. And it's an amazing story, insight into how politicians respond to movements. Now, I realize that a couple of LBJ historians have come out and said, well, you know, because LBJ early on in the movie, he's saying to Martin Luther King is saying, we need voting rights now. LBJ had already signed the Civil Rights Bill, but Martin Luther King was saying, now we need explicit legal protections, federal legal protections for voting. And down in Alabama, there was an entire county, it was predominantly black. Not a single black person was registered to vote. And in fact, the movie starts out with the old literacy test shtick, which was not that old. I mean, this was like, what, 1967? 66? And the amazing thing in the movie, and the presidential historians, they're saying, well, you know, LBJ said that, you know, the night that Kennedy was killed, he said, you know, we want to use this to get the Voting Rights Act passed. Well, yeah. But he was also a politician, and he also was looking for the moment to pass the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, in the movie, it's portrayed as Martin Luther King basically provided him with that moment. And the presidential historians are saying LBJ was a co-conspirator in that. He was saying to Martin Luther King, hey, give me the moment. I'll take it and use it. The distinction between those two is fairly small. And, I don't think that this diminishes LBJ's legacy at all. And I get it that the woman who was the producer and director of the film told Salon Magazine, I think it was, that she didn't want to make another white savior movie. And so, you know, the whole Martin Luther King or the whole LBJ playing a role in this part was somewhat downplayed. I don't think that, I don't think the movie is that far from what's accurate from what I know of that era. And I'm not a scholar of the LBJ era, but I lived through it. I was there. I mean, I wasn't there at the marches, but I was, you know. I was a teenager at that time, but I remember it. And B, not only in this movie, and I'm not giving away the movie here. You will see this, and this movie will astonish you. Not only did the movement politics of Martin Luther King push not just LBJ but all of America. I mean, at a certain point in the movie, Martin Luther King makes the point to his peers, to his colleagues, we're not just trying to move black America, we're trying to wake up white America. And he did. And that's very clear in the movie. But then later on in the movie, Martin Luther King kind of wavers, and this young teenager by the name of John Lewis, who's now a member of Congress, who was with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee with SNCC down in Selma, pushes Martin Luther King. So it's like this total, the whole message of the movie is ground up activism is how you change a country. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. It's brilliant movie making. It's brilliant acting. I had tears in my eyes at least a half a dozen times through the movie, and it wasn't because of the violence. The violence was, I mean, it was, you know, white cops beating up black marchers. I mean, it's just, we all watched it on TV back in the 60s. In fact, it's what moved America. I would take my kids to this movie. I would take a little kid to this movie. This is just amazing. So how do we fulfill the legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King? I think basically he has multiple legacies. First of all, he has the legacy of civil rights and voting rights, speaking up, standing up for the African-American community, and frankly, all minorities. Secondly, and these last two are largely forgotten by history because they're inconvenient truths for the Republican Party and thus for the conservative historians and the conservative media in the United States. Secondly, Martin Luther King was a tireless fighter and rhetorician against the Vietnam War. He was a pacifist. He was opposed to the Vietnam War. And third, he was an outspoken spokesperson for a reasonable minimum wage. I mean, a serious, genuine, reasonable minimum wage. I got too much paper now on top of my... this makes me crazy. There is just an incredible speech that he gave. Oh, by the way, in this voter ID laws, you know, it's not only how do we fulfill the dream of Dr. King, but how do we stop it from going backwards? As I said, happy Robert E. Lee Day. I think, just parenthetically, I've talked many times with you about how when Gerry Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, and then Bill Clinton essentially pardoned, well, George Herbert Walker Bush pardoned a whole bunch of Reagan cronies for Iran-Contra. And then Bill Clinton essentially pardoned George Herbert Walker Bush by not prosecuting him for his role in Iran-Contra. And then Obama pardoned George W. Bush. Well, I think, you know, the original sin was not Gerry Ford pardoning Richard Nixon. The original sin was Andrew Johnson not hanging Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee was a traitor to the United States of America. He not just a traitor, he raised an army and took on our country. And Lee and Jackson and those guys, they should have been hung. Or hanged, I guess is the correct word. So anyhow, but they weren't. We kind of forgave them, and now they've been rehabilitated by history. And now this report issued Wednesday by the General Accounting Office found that fewer African Americans have, you know, the ID necessary to vote. In the last election, black turnout dropped 3.7 percentage points more than white turnout did in Kansas and 1.5 percentage points more than whites in Tennessee after voter ID laws were passed. We are going backwards. We're going back into Jim Crow. So what do we do about this? How do we get through this? Anyhow, that's going on. There's a whole bunch of other stuff going on. There's economic news. There's war and peace news. There is. It's just, you know, we'll continue. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For example, Oxfam just released a report as Davos begins, where the rich and famous meet, that the 1% now own half the planet. Seriously. Welcome back. This is Steve Bannon writing over on Rachel Maddow's blog, the Maddow blog. The URL I don't have. My printer didn't print it, but it's easy to find. Anyhow, Steve Bannon writes, he actually quotes Malcolm Jones, who says, By the way, the Arkansas Secretary of State's Steve Benner writes, the Arkansas Secretary of State's page specifically notes that Arkansas today celebrates both Martin Luther King Day and Robert E. Lee Day. He was the Confederate general, you'll recall. Five southern states, this is what Malcolm Jones writes, five southern states officially celebrate Lee's birthday. Virginia was, I think, over the weekend. And Alabama, Arkansas, and Mississippi celebrate both men's birthdays on the same day. Put it more bluntly, King deserves a holiday in his honor, and Lee does not. I mean, Robert E. Lee was responsible for the death of 600,000 Americans, for the bloodiest war that America's ever had. Civil wars are horrible things. And he did it to defend slavery. So here we have this GAO report that as these ALEC-promoted voter ID laws are promulgated, more and more African Americans are not able to vote. Other ways that the right to vote, which is at the core of the movie Selma, that the right to vote has been rolled back. Look at Florida in 2000. I think this is like an absolute case. Somewhere between 60 and 90,000 African Americans knocked off the voting rolls in Florida just before the election by Jeb Bush, by Catherine Harris at the order of Jeb Bush, the then governor of the state, Catherine Harris, the Secretary of State. Because they had names that were similar to, not identical to, similar to felons in Texas. This is Florida. There's something like 1,000 miles between the two. And that got the margin of error so small that George W. Bush was able to steal that election by taking it to the Supreme Court, which is not in the Constitution. And this is the kind of crazy, crazy, nutty stuff that goes on. So, anyhow, as I said, if you have not seen Selma, go see that movie. That is an amazing piece of movie making. It is an amazing piece of history. Every American should see this. Every white American absolutely has to see it. Black Americans who do not remember the 60s absolutely have to see it. And those who do remember the 60s, they're going to find inspiration in it too. I mean, this is just, and really people of all races, people of all, they say gay rights is the new civil rights, whatever it may be. What this movie does is it demonstrates how movement politics, I think, in the last couple of years, we've seen this with the gay rights, the gay marriage rights movement, how movement politics moves politics, how movement activity creates political activity, changes. This is important stuff. Anyhow, we're going to be back with Reverend Bullock, and then after that I'll be taking your calls. So if you're on the line, stick around. We'll pick it up after the break at the bottom of the hour. Joining us past the hour, welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. And on the line with us is the Reverend D. Alexander Bullock, the Executive Director of the Change Agent Consortium. Go over to Facebook.com/ActionCAC is their website, ActionCAC. And Reverend Bullock, welcome back to the program.
Tom, great to be back. Good to be back.
It is always great having you with us, sir. I'm assuming you've seen Selma.
I saw Selma in D.C. actually around the Christmas holiday at one of the special premieres, and I was listening to your comments before the break. I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, it really demonstrates how a movement can shape public policy, how movement politics can move the country forward. But it also, for me, struck a chord around the issue of voting and how 50 years ago, we were fighting for equality before the law, fighting for everyone to have not only the right but actually access to voting. And it seems 50 years later, whether you talk about what happened in Florida, you talk about emergency management in Michigan, you talk about voter suppression across the nation, 50 years later, we seem to still be fighting to protect the franchise and make sure that voting matters in a significant way. And so Selma then became alive, more than just a movie about Dr. King and what happened back then. It became a movie about what needs to happen right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And for example, we've got this new GAO report that found in the wake of these voter ID laws that ALEC is promoting and are being passed by state after state, that this is from a report by Reed Wilson over at the government beat, not sure the blog here, but it says black turnout dropped 3.7 percentage points more than white turnout in Kansas and by 1.5 percentage points more than whites in Tennessee after voter ID laws passed. And these laws are supposed to keep people, quote, who aren't Americans from voting. And of course, the right wingers who push these things say, oh, it's going to be the Mexicans who are coming in, you know. But really what it's all about is suppressing the black vote in the United States, in my opinion. Your thoughts?
No, I agree. I think it's about suppressing the black vote. I think it's about suppressing the vote of low to middle income persons, folks that would obviously have a public policy leaning towards strong union, strong federal government, strong equality legislation. And, you know, and I think that, you know, it's amazing that that struggle for the franchise, for equality before the law continues. You know, so even as we celebrate Dr. King on today, you know, we cannot just talk about what Dr. King did. We cannot just remember Selma, the I Have a Dream speech, or even the Poor People's Campaign, which I think is some uncharted territory and some unfinished business that we must continue. But we don't just look backwards. We look forwards. We plant our feet and we discover that we have to continue to fight for the full franchise for all Americans. I think also this whole question of not being American, not being a citizen, maybe not even being human, is an interesting rhetoric and ideology that is so persistent in a negative way in this country, and is used to try to exclude certain people from being a part of the American experiment, which is democracy. You know, so in Detroit today, we're marching against police brutality, also registering people to vote, also talking about the franchise, but focusing on police brutality. Because what we've seen is not only are people dehumanized in a way that excludes them from democracy, but they're dehumanized in a way that excludes them from being able to get justice when there's excessive or wanton, cruel police force use. So whether it's Ferguson, whether it's Eric Garner in Staten Island, or Mackenzie Cochran, who was choked to death in a mall right outside of the city of Detroit in Southfield, Michigan. What we've discovered is that the threshold is so high that really no law enforcement officer will ever be convicted criminally of killing anybody. And so that means we've got to register to vote. We've got to vote. We've got to change the public policy. We've got to change the rules so that nobody is above the law.
Yeah.
So we march today to continue that movement.
So you're marching in Detroit today. Where and how, or where and when, rather?
We're marching today at 2 p.m., 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We are meeting at Harford Memorial Baptist Church, which is at 18700 James Cousins. We're marching to the site where Mackenzie Cochran was killed. We're marching to Northland Mall, which is about a mile and a half away. So it's a short march. We're not marching from Selma to Montgomery. We're just marching from 7 mile to 8.5 mile. But we're gonna stop at Northland Mall where Mackenzie Cochran was killed. We're gonna go into the mall, go to the site where he was killed, where we will have a die-in to symbolize and dramatize his death, as well as the level of police brutality that we've seen across the nation, but the dehumanization of African Americans and urban populations, with respect to law enforcement and the democratic process. So you know, we believe that Dr. King would be on the front line today, fighting for inclusion in democracy and fighting for equality before the law for all American citizens.
Well, I think of Dr. Martin Luther King, and I think of you, sir. You are carrying on his legacy, and you're doing great work. Did you see the story about the black police officer, police chief, who showed up at a white supremacist's house The white supremacist shot him four times, three times in the chest. Fortunately, he had a bulletproof vest on, so he survived. The white supremacist was arrested and then released. Yeah. I mean, it's like, man, I'm looking at that going, Tamir Rice? You know, anyway.
You know, it's amazing that when you think about a case like that, you know, that case is so glaring, and it shows that there are two sets of rules.
Yeah.
And that we have a legal system that does everybody equally. You know, so again, the struggle continues. Doctor inspires us. We follow his example, and we attempt to move America forward.
There you go. Get over to facebook.com/ActionCAC, the Change Agent Consortium. ActionCAC. Reverend D. Alexander Bullock, the Executive Director of the Change Agent Consortium. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And happy Martin Luther King.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
I'm not sure I could ever say happy Robert E. Lee. Can't do it. I'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And again, I've got a part of a speech from Dr. Martin Luther King that I will share with you as the day goes on. Here is the beginning of it, and then I'm going to pick up your phone calls. This was, do you have the date for the, oh, here it is. This was at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta on the 4th of July in 1965. And he said, "This is why we must join the war against poverty and believe in the dignity of all work. What makes a job menial? I'm tired of this stuff about menial labor. What makes it menial is that you don't pay folks anything. Give somebody a job and pay them some money so they can live and educate their children and buy a home and have the basic necessities of life. And no matter what the job is, it takes on dignity." And then he goes on from there, and I will share the rest of that with you in a little while. But this we now have jobs where you cannot live working at that job. In fact, about half of all Americans have a job that is not adequate for them to live at. And that's just wrong. It's just wrong. Carl in Charleston, South Carolina. Hey, Carl. Thanks for calling.
Tom, I just want to let you know that I watch your show all the time, and I thought it was ironic I got to talk to you today on Martin Luther King's birthday, and watched your discussion about Selma, mm-hmm. which I thought was also another irony. In lieu of all these things that are happening in our country with black people, Hispanic people, and just the general nature of the United States,
yeah.
It makes you wonder where we're going. So I just wanted to share that with you.
So you saw the movie, Selma?
Yes.
What did you think of it?
I thought it was it's out of sight.
Yeah. Are you old enough to remember that era?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was around. I was went to college in the late 50s and the early 60s, and I was in all the revolutions, everything that was going on right up to this day.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful picture, and I just want to let you know that I enjoy your show.
Well, thank you, Carl.
You know, and I hope to talk to you again.
Okay, I'm sure we will. Carl, thanks again for the call and for your kind words. Bill in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Bill.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
A couple of things. First off, I want to let you know I am a Vietnam veteran, and I've grown up here in the Detroit area pretty much most of my life from the early to mid-50s. And into the 60s. And I remember when they still had segregated bathrooms in most of our public parks, both in Ferndale and in Royal Oak. And I used to ask my father about that, being the good 8-year-old liberal kid that I was at the time. And he gave me the typical conservative answer. That's just the way it is. Leave me alone.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the one specific memory I have. I've been told by one of my brothers that there were fountains and there was a swimming pool in Lansing that were segregated. I don't remember that, but I do remember the one of the fanciest hotels, and I think it was the Jack Tar Hotel, which had a very nice restaurant in downtown Lansing, Michigan, in the 50s. And I was born in 51, so you know I was under 10, and they had a side entrance that said colored entrance. I remember that. I can see it. And
not only that, when I was in high school, I graduated in 71, and I graduated from Marlo Kimball High School, which is they were back in 71, they were still deciding whether they wanted to celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday. So our entire senior class decided we were going to practice a little nonviolent protest. So the entire senior class decided to take most of the morning and early afternoon off, and we went into the center courtyard of our school, and we had a sit-down protest. And we talked about nonviolent protest and
wow.
The whole thing.
Wow. Great stuff. Great stuff. Bill, thanks for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. Dave, my question, how do we fulfill Dr. King's dream? Dave in Canterbury, Connecticut. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom, that's a good question, and that's basically one of the things I want to talk about today. I'm a union man. I belong to Martin King's stated most favorite union, 1199. We went into the South and tried to organize poor healthcare workers. But anyway, I live in Eastern Connecticut, Tom, and basically out here, it's all basically all white, and the white people are very poorly educated to this holiday. Number one, they don't see it as a national holiday, that Martin King believed in justice for all people. And what really, really bothers me, the way the press diminishes this holiday, Tom, where I live, they'll go around and they'll find a few African-American faces. Well, how do you feel about Martin King Day? And how do you feel about the dream? You know, but they never talk to a white person. And white people think it's a black holiday, Tom.
Yeah.
And they need to be educated better. And until the press catches on to that,
well, this is the problem. This is the problem, Dave. As I said, I think there's three consequential, and there's probably more. If you know of others, you know, call me and let me know. But three consequential legacies of Dr. King's. The first was, you know, civil rights for African Americans and all minorities. The second was the inherent dignity of work, right? Raising people out of poverty and making sure people had jobs. And the third was his opposition to war, to stupid and unnecessary wars, like the Vietnam War specifically. And in fact, let me just read, I had said earlier, I'll read this later on, but you just set this up perfectly. Dave, thank you for the call. Let me go off on a rant here. This is from this speech that Martin Luther King gave on July 4th, 1965 in his church in Atlanta. I read you the setup for it. He says, this is why we must join the war against poverty. Now just listen. And see if you hear any reference to people of color in this speech at all, because it's not there. He is talking about the rights of all people, white, black, Hispanic, Asian, you name it, Native American, the rights of all people to have dignity associated with their work. He said, I submit to you that when I took off on that plane this morning, I saw men go out there in their overhauls. I saw them working on things here and there and saw some more going out to put the breakfast on the plane so we could eat on our way to Atlanta. And I said to myself that these people who constitute the ground crew are just as significant as the pilot, because this plane couldn't move if you didn't have the ground crew. I submit to you that Hugh Spaulding or Grady Hospital, these are hospitals, the woman or the man who goes in there to sweep the floor is just as significant as the doctor, because if he doesn't get that dust off the floor, germs will begin to circulate. And those same germs can do injury and harm to the human being. I submit to you this morning that there is dignity in all work. And when we learn to pay people decent, and we must learn to pay people decent wages, whoever cooks in your house, whoever sweeps the floor in your house, is just as significant as anybody who lives in that house. And everybody that we call a maid is serving God in a significant way. And I love maids. I love the people who have been ignored, and I want to see them get the kind of wages that they need. And their job is no longer a menial job for you to come see its worth and dignity. Are we really taking this thing seriously? All men are created equal? That means that every man who lives in a slum today is just as significant as John D. Nelson or any other Rockefeller. Any man who lives in a slum is just as significant as Henry Ford. All men are created equal, and they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, rights that can't be separated from you. Go down and tell them, you may take my life, but you can't take my right to life. You may take my liberty, but you can't take my right to liberty. You may take from me the desire. You may take from me the propensity to pursue happiness, but you cannot take from me the right to pursue happiness. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Then he goes off on this. But this, you know, this should be, the Martin Luther King holiday should be a celebration of unionization, of workers' rights, of anti-war sentiment, and of civil rights. Now, you know, you could probably reverse the order of that because his first order of business was civil rights and voting rights. And that's then the movie Selma just, you know, nails that. But anyhow, Dewan in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Dewan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, thanks for taking my call. Sure. Calling from southwestern Virginia. And, you know, as a historian, I think it's really important to remember our history and from whence all this ugliness.
Are you a historian?
See today. Yeah, actually, my bachelor's is in history, and I'm a social studies teacher.
Cool, that's great.
Yeah, so I had heard from a history professor, and then I found some documentation on the internet here that at Virginia Tech, on the day that Dr. King was assassinated, there was. Strom Thurmond was speaking. What I now read from the Virginia Tech website is that it was actually a debate between the NAACP executive director, Roy Wilkins, and Senator Strom Thurmond. But according to this now-retired history professor who was in the audience when the announcement was made that King had been assassinated, there was spontaneous applause.
Oh, Jesus. This is the University of Virginia. Virginia, by the way, this weekend celebrating Robert E. Lee's birthday, officially.
Oh, well, it's not just right. It is called Lee Jackson Day here, Tom.
Right.
Lee Jackson Day.
Today and, or was that Saturday or Sunday?
Friday. Yeah, last Friday.
Last Friday.
The only
was
way
Lee Jackson Day. Okay.
That they would agree to adopt the King holiday was to have Lee Jackson Day. And I've heard tell, although I haven't seen it, but I've heard tell that people burn $5 bills on Lee Jackson Day.
Because Lincoln's picture.
Anyway, so that would be correct. Yeah. So according to this Virginia Tech website that references an article that was published in their magazine, it's called Remembering the Pioneers, this woman, let's see here, Lucy Rowland, class of 69 at Tech, she references that it was a debate going on.
Huh. Devon, we're out of time, but thank you for sharing that story. That's extraordinary. Thank you so much, and thanks for watching. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
How can we most effectively fulfill the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King? I think the first step is to stop electing Republicans. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I don't know if you can hear the guy with the chainsaw outside. Somebody's working on Martin Luther King. Well, I guess I am. What can I say? Matt in Cazenovia, New York. Hey, Matt, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Sure. Just a couple quick things. First was the requirement for picture ID to vote.
Yeah.
I think any state that requires that should also be required by the federal government to provide said ID free of charge.
Well, they do, but the free of charge part is, it's never free of charge because in order to get that ID, you've got to get other documents, which cost money. You've got to drive to the DMV, go to the DMV, which many people don't have the ability to do. There are costs associated with this that are typically in the neighborhood of $25 to $100, and I would argue that those represent a poll tax, which is unconstitutional.
Well, I think they should just have to supply it, period.
Yeah.
I mean, if they have to cover all the costs, should have to, if they're going to require that, then they need to balance it both ways. And the other quick comment was the low wages that all these companies are paying, I believe it's to get around the 40-hour work week. Because then they can put you to work full-time at their place, and then you can go work full-time somewhere else, and you're still barely at the poverty level. It's part of the plan for Third World America.
Yeah, I'm with you. Thank you, Matt. Thanks for the call. Al in Cathedral City, California. Hey, Al.
Hi, Tom. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
I agree with you. I could never say Happy Robert E. Lee Day. But I think it's the people and the culture that smear this one guy. Robert E. Lee wasn't a politician. He was a soldier. He grew up as a young guy. He grew up with his mom because his dad ran off and left him. His dad was Washington's favorite lieutenant, High Horse Harry Lee. But his mom raised him. His mom taught him to revere General Washington. He came through West Point with only two demerits.
at the time Virginia voted to secede from the Union, he was still in the Union Army. He didn't know what to do.
Well, he apparently did know what to do. I mean, he led the Confederate Army, and that's why I say he should have been hanged by Andrew Johnson.
Well, you know, it's funny. Henry Adams, at the same time...
I mean, Aaron Burr, was it Aaron Burr? No. Benedict Arnold had an illustrious history and an extraordinary background, but that doesn't make him any less of a traitor.
Yeah, he was a traitor, but I think it's hard for me to call Robert E. Lee a traitor because he was a Virginian. And
his behavior led to the death of 600,000 people.
Well, he's not the only one that had armies. Braxton Bragg had an army. Pierre Toutant Beauregard had an army. Sidney Johnson had an army.
And they all should have been charged with treason.
Well,
every single one of them. And, you know, Lincoln and Johnson were so committed to, quote, healing the nation that they made the exact same mistake that Gerry Ford made with Richard Nixon. They said, we're going to overlook the crimes. And once you overlook the crimes continue. They just take a different shape. I mean, you know, slavery was, quote, officially done away with. And what did we get? We got Plessy versus Ferguson. We got Jim Crow. We got, you know, to this day, we have the legacy of slavery. In my opinion, in part because we did not hold the people who defended slavery to account. But that's just me. Al, thanks for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you and Lee in Las Vegas, New Mexico. Or is that New Mexico or Nevada?
No, that's Las Vegas, Nevada.
Nevada. Okay, cool. Lee, what's up?
Yes. Hey, you know what? I'm a man of color. Next month, I'll be 75 years old. I was born and raised just 18 miles north of Waco in a little town called West, where they had the explosion here. But we sung four songs every morning. Eyes of Texas are upon you, the Star Spangled Banner, lift every voice and sing, and my country tis of thee. And we were in a farm community, but I'm speaking with the black kids. We had four buses plus a connect to bring in kids in from around the county. But we would get out of school the end of May. We'd be out of school for 6 weeks. Then we would get out of school, so we'd be at the harvest season. Our football season started in September, and actually we went back to school in October, and the state of Texas rewarded us. And when I say us, I'm speaking of the kids from small farming communities. We could actually go to the Texas State Fair the first Monday in October and pay to ride a ride. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to share that. And you know, Ronald Reagan did more to hurt this country as far as race relations than anybody on the face of the earth, because he came with the separation message.
Yeah.
We can't hire you because we have to hire the colors, you know?
Yeah. He was playing people off against each other and the whole, yeah, yeah. And in fact, I mean, the first speech that Ronald Reagan gave after he was his party nominated him to be the presidential candidate in 1980. The first speech he gave was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and it was about states' rights. You know, the place where the three civil rights workers were murdered. I'm with you, Lee. Thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM, and thanks for sharing your story with us. Gary in Minneapolis. Hey, Gary.
Good morning, Tom. I'd just like to start by saying the thing that I'm thankful for is my folks were heavy into labor. They gave me a labor education. And in Minneapolis in the 50s, it was a white town. In my grade school, I grew up with people different than me. It was the only grade school where most of the black kids went, and I was white. So I was exposed to people different than me, and it's led me through life to be a better person. And also surviving turning into something positive, living with manic depression, has turned into something positive. It's really helped me a lot in life.
That's good.
And that's basically the first things I said. And I've learned that people are different than me. I learn from them, and I embrace meeting people that are like immigrants, the new immigrants and stuff. I really learn a lot from them, and I wish people wouldn't be so bigoted and against people because of their differences.
I'm with you. Gary, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to AM 950 there in Minneapolis. Helen, in Ithaca, New York, listening on AM 1470. Hey, Helen.
Boy, that last person, Gary, he sounds like he should canonize his fate or something. What a very good person he sounds like. Well, what I'm calling about is this would be perfect timing to change the name of that bridge that goes from Selma to Montgomery.
The Edmund Pettus Bridge?
Pardon?
The Edmund Pettus Bridge?
Yeah, it's named after the head honcho of the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh, really? How did I miss that?
Yeah. Well, unless NPR and ABC News has things all screwed up, that's how I learned this. I should have researched myself before I called you, but he was also a U.S. state senator from Alabama.
Uh-huh.
And this would be perfect timing to call it either Martin Luther King Bridge or Lewis Bridge, something like that. Change the name of that bridge where all those people were beaten and bludgeoned.
I'm with you. Helen, thank you for sharing that. That's fascinating. Kathy in Lindale, Texas. Hey, Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Tom. I'm a little bit off topic. The reason I'm calling is with the Supreme Court done a rule on same-sex marriage. Why do we think that matters? They ruled on abortions are legal, and look at where we're at. You know, it's just so many other things.
Yeah, no, I understand, Kathy, and I'll get to that at another time. I want to stay on this topic. Michael in Smithfield, North Carolina. Hey, Michael.
Now, hey, how you doing, Tom? It's good to hear from you again.
Thank you.
And Tom, and North Carolina has just passed a little over a year ago new voting laws that require, it's very harsh, you know, in my personal opinion, if you, North Carolina's new voter ID law, it's very harsh, and, you know, and I agree with your point of view, you know, people may not have access to go to a DMV, and...
Well, it's not just a point of view. I mean, this, according to the General Accounting Office, black turnout dropped 3.7 percentage points more than white turnout did in Kansas when they instituted their voter ID law, and 1.5% more down from whites in Tennessee after they passed a voter ID law. This is exactly what these guys, this is why Republicans push for these laws.
Yeah, and first of all, that's Republicans for you, and two, the Republican Party has gotten worse about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, in recent years, maybe even longer, you know, the Republican Party, in my personal opinion, is a bunch of racists, but they don't want to admit that.
Yeah, I'm with you. Actually, quite a few of them do. They just don't do it in more public venues. Thanks a lot, Michael, for the call. Joyce, or they do it in code. Joyce in Deer Lodge, Montana, we have a little less than a minute. Joyce, can you make a quick point, please?
I'm going to try, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. And just wanted to relate a personal story. When Dr. Martin Luther King was killed, I'm in my 80s now. I lived in upstate New York at the time, and I had a dear, dear black friend, and he spent the summer or the winters down south. After Martin Luther King was killed, he came back up to New York because the police were stopping him constantly.
Mm.
The Highway Patrol.
Yep. This is the legacy of this we see in the police actions that have led to the response of the Black Lives Matters #/movement. I mean, we live in extraordinary times. Now, once again, let me just plug this shamelessly here. If you haven't seen the movie Selma, go see it. Go see it today. Give me a call about it tomorrow if you do. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, and the Dr. Clarence Lussaine is with us. He is a professor of Comparative and Regional Studies Program at the School of International Service at American University, a commissioner with the District of Columbia Commission on African American Affairs, the author of The Black History of the White House, the website American.edu, and Dr. Lussaine, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So pleased to have you with us. So you were telling me just before we went on the air that your grandmother, was it, was in Selma?
My grandmother was one of the organizers in Alabama. She lived right outside of Birmingham in Bessemer and had been active for many, many years. In fact, she was one of less than 100 African-Americans who registered to vote in her area out of something like 20,000. Right. So she was a very brave individual. She worked on the 1963 children marches in protest that took place in Birmingham, where King and the activists, about 4,000 children, school children, were arrested for demonstrating for civil rights. So she was active in that. And she knew and worked with the families of the people, the four girls who died in the church bombing in Birmingham. And she was on the Pettus Bridge. She was on two of those marches.
What was your take on the movie Selma?
I think it's a magnificent movie. It gives you what you don't see in Hollywood. When you think about civil rights as it's been portrayed, when you look at Mississippi Burning, it's really about the FBI and their kind of arguments and basically putting them in an ahistorical position of defending civil rights when, in fact, they actually didn't. Or you look at even like a movie like Lincoln, where the voices of African Americans are basically erased. They're simply background. What we get with Selma for the first time, really, in a Hollywood film is that the people who actually were in the front, who were actually on the ground, who actually put their lives out there to fight for civil rights are foreground. And you get to hear those voices. You get to hear the leaders, people like Diane Nash, for example, other local leaders in Selma who, other than civil rights sort of historians, are generally people who are not known. Right there in the film, as well as just the thousands of unknown people who decided that they would march on the bridge, they would march in the demonstrations, they would put themselves on the line for voting rights and for civil rights. And so the film does that, I think, in ways that we normally don't see in Hollywood films.
Yeah. The two things that were just very lightly touched on in the movie that I think are also very significant parts of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's legacy are his advocacy for workers' rights, all workers. And even for his dismissal of the idea that there is such a thing as a menial job, that all work has dignity, and therefore all work should have reasonable pay associated with it, regardless of race or station or whatever, number one. And number two, his opposition to the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I asked the question earlier of my audience, how do we work to fulfill Dr. King's legacy?
Well, I think you hit on a couple of important points. People forget that the 1963 march had 10 demands. Half of those demands were about workers' rights. They were about increasing the minimum wage. They were about policies to prohibit discrimination in hiring. So the civil rights movement, particularly as it emerged in the 1940s from A. Philip Randolph, kind of all the way through the 1960s and 70s and forward, has always had a link in with broader kinds of issues. And again, as you point out, particularly workers' issues and the fact that it's not just opportunities that have to open up, but people have to have the conditions there so they can take advantage of opportunities. And then the other thing that comes across in the movie is the way in which there's other radical voices that King has to deal with that are pushing him to the left and pushing him to not just settle, but that you really have to keep this challenge going. So the young folks from SNCC, for example, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, John Lewis, and in the movie, Malcolm X shows up.
Yeah.
And that's historically accurate. Malcolm X, literally 2 weeks before he was assassinated, came to Selma, Alabama. He wanted to meet with Martin Luther King. King was in jail, so he met with Coretta Scott King, which you see in the movie. What they don't show in the movies, he also gave a talk to about 300 or so local people, right, which was very enthusiastically received. So the film is good at sort of kind of showing, and I think what's relevant today is that there are a lot of issues that are linked together. And when we look at issues like police abuse, and we see what happened in Ferguson and what happened in New York and what happened in Ohio, those are not separate from broader policy issues that have disempowered people so that these communities don't have the capacity to have the public policy in place where they can decide who's the police chief, or if the police are abusive, that they can be dismissed and they can be fired.
Which takes us back to the essence of the movie, which is, if I can't vote, what can I, you know, how can I have any influence over anything? And you've got situations like in 2000 where Jeb Bush told Catherine Harris, you know, take a list of felons from Texas, run it against people in Florida, and you're going to get disproportionately African American names. And they knocked 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls in Florida just weeks before the election, which got Bush close enough that he could get the Supreme Court to steal the election for him. I mean, it's astonishing. We're still doing it.
In 1965, people died for voting rights.
Literally.
Right. People literally died. And here we are 50 years later, 50th anniversary here in 2015. And in many ways, more insidious type of voting policy are in existence that have such devastating impact. One, for example, is felony disenfranchisement.
Right.
So in Florida, for example, 400,000 African Americans cannot vote.
Because they have a felony.
Because they have a felony on their record, and the laws in Florida won't allow them, for the most part, to be able to get out of a position where they can actually vote. And that exists in state after state after state around the country. Some states, and part of the problem is that we've got at least 50 different election systems,
yeah,
because every state has its own rules about how it's going to operate. That's one of the, I think, one of the goals we should be looking at now when we think about voting rights, is that we move away from just leaving it to the states, which has historically been how it's been done, but that we actually need, like every other country on the planet, a uniform, fair national election system.
Yeah.
And I think that really has to be at the top of the agenda for voting rights activists, even as you're battling these immediate battles over voting restriction laws.
Right. Yeah. And then the continuing economic impact of discrimination on black families. The last time I looked, and I've seen different numbers on these, but the proportions always seem about the same.
Yeah.
But a typical African-American family in the United States today has around $5,000 in assets. A typical white family in the United States today has around $80,000 in assets. This is not an accident. This is a consequence of a very clear history. What
right.
do we do about it?
Well, and the wealth gap has actually went up and down.
Yeah.
And so it's not immutable. It can be impacted. But that requires intervention, public policy that very specifically targets addressing the issues of wealth, the wealth gap, the income gap. The same thing with the unemployment gap. The records go back comparing black and white differentials in terms of unemployment back to about 1963 or so. And from that period up to now, it essentially has averaged doubling of white unemployment. That, even when white unemployment has went down and black unemployment, that doubling effect has still been there. So it really is going to require public policy and a concentration on the issues that prevent the kind of equity in employment and equity in wealth and in income that we see, and that just goes on and on and on.
Isn't,
and no one's addressing.
Yeah, I agree. And isn't, to a large extent, this lack of equity in employment the tip of a very large iceberg, most of which is underwater, which is like lack of equity in education, lack of equity in childcare, lack of equity in housing? You know? Can you stick around for a little bit?
Yeah, I can.
Let's continue the conversation. We're talking with Dr. Clarence Lussain, professor of Comparative and Regional Studies Program at the School of International Service at American University, and a commissioner of the D.C. Commission on African-American Affairs, author of The Black History of the White House. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can read about Dr. Lussain and his work over at American.edu and check out his book, The Black History of the White House. And welcome back. Dr. Lussain is still with us. And we were talking about the wealth gap, in the racial wealth gap in this country. What do you think are the, or no? I mean, what did you, you're a scholar of this stuff. You know, I'm just a commentator. What is the basis of that? What are the main pressure points? What are the areas that we really need to be attending to right now to help resolve that?
Okay, you're more than a commentator. You actually have important insights, I think.
Thank you.
Just even kind of raising these questions, because you generally are not hearing these issues being raised. There is a very good paper that was put out by the Economic Policy Institute called The Making of Ferguson. And what that paper does, it traces the history and the evolution of the creation of Ferguson and the ways in which a long history of racial covenants, mm-hmm. of zoning laws that were biased, of policy, federal policy, state policy, that had an impact in shaping what we now know as the very desperate situation that people face in Ferguson, the economic situation, the social situation. So when we look around the country, we have to look at not just the attitudes of people. It's not just about prejudice. It really is about the policies that historically have existed that were explicitly racist, the policies that emerged that on their face were neutral but had disproportionate racial impact, and then the policies that further economic power upward.
Yeah.
The things that Thomas Pinckney and other people have written about the ways in which the
we can get very personal and specific about this. I mean, for example, I'll just tell you a little bit of my story. My dad worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years, which got my family into the middle class. But he was able to do that and to buy the house that he had. Back then, unions were largely keeping African-Americans out. This was a union shop. My dad was white. I mean, you know, that was my principal inheritance. I got nothing from my family. My father hadn't, no inheritance, but I got white skin from him. I got white privilege from him. So number one, he was able to work in a union shop. Number two, he came back from World War II, and on the GI Bill, he was able to buy a house. African-Americans came back from World War II. They couldn't buy houses because they were redlined. Number three, he came back on the GI Bill. He went to college for a couple of years until my mom got pregnant with me and he dropped out. African-Americans came back. They couldn't use the GI Bill. There were schools that wouldn't take them.
Right.
I mean, do I have this right? I mean, this is the basis of just a generation away of this disparity.
And I grew up in Detroit. And when I came out of high school in the early 70s, I literally was able to walk to the factory and start working, literally within 24 hours. High-paying job at that point. Hard work. Brutally hard work, but high-paying job. Within 10 years, factories close. So post-industrialization societies have had wretched impact across this country, disproportionately on those who most could afford not to be able to, who could only get into the middle class through that kind of hard work. They weren't getting through college attendance, but they could get in. Their children could go to college.
Right?
That has gone. And we have abandoned large sectors of this country, disproportionately black, but disproportionately working people.
Yeah.
Right. So nobody's giving that attention, Democrat or Republican.
Yeah. And I would point to our insane trade policies as the principal villain there. But that's a whole other conversation. Stick around. We'll be right back with Dr. Clarence Lussain. Here with you, taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Dr. Clarence Lussain with us, the author of The Black History of the White House, professor of Comparative and Regional Studies Program at the Is that, am I saying it right?
In the
Comparative and Regional Studies program at the School of International Service at American University. You were saying about your dissertation?
Yeah, my dissertation focused on the impact of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, on black employment in the United States. But the broader context, though, is we live in a global world now. Yeah. And one of the things I think we can learn from Martin Luther King was that he actually did think in global terms. And he's actually had kind of a global impact. And one of the things that I find frustrating has been so much attention paid to his domestic politics that it's really kind of underplayed the degree to which both he thought in a global context and which he had a impact. So, for example, Tiananmen Square, the demonstrations that took place in China in 1989, the leaders of that demonstration, the youth leaders, very explicitly studied Martin Luther King before they went into action.
Wow.
If we look at the Occupy movement that just happened in Hong Kong this past fall, those leaders also explicitly studied Martin Luther King. So I think our understanding of King has to broaden so that we see that he really was a profound thinker, not just on domestic politics, but in ways in which he was increasingly seen we're all globally tied together. And
yeah.
then when we talk about these issues of employment and these issues of development, they're not single issues affecting one single country or one community. They really are globally linked.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, another piece that seems to be lost to history, or at least lost to mainstream history, is that in 68, the Poor People's March, was the first Occupy movement, six weeks on the Mall. It's like the Occupy, and we're covering the Occupy movement here in Washington, D.C. a couple of years ago, and nobody's saying, right. Oh, this is the second time we've done this.
Resurrecting City.
Yes.
Actually, you could argue that the student sit-ins that happened in beginning of 1960. But certainly the Occupy.
Well, you can take it back to the bonus arm.
The way we think about Occupy, you're absolutely right. The Resurrection City, 1968, Martin Luther King's last campaign.
Yeah.
Right. Really was, we have to sit here until we get some transformation, until we get change.
Yeah, it's true. Where, looking forward, what do we do? Where do we go? What can white people of good conscience do to have an impact on this as well as people of color?
Well, I think there are a number of things. One is mass mobilization. Yeah. There has to be a groundswell that brings pressure to policymakers, elected officials, that only comes from having people mobilized in the hundreds of thousands, millions, right? Secondly, I think we really have to link up with people around the world who are engaging in many of these issues. People around the world are responding to Ferguson. They responded to issues that happened in New York, and you see there's hashtags, there's websites, So there really are ways which we can link and make sure that there's we don't just have a narrow kind of perspective. Then I think that people really have to look at issues of public and political involvement. And I think that means we have to not lock ourselves into Republican and Democrat kinds of boxes, but really look at what are the issues that really have to be taken up in any political party. Anybody that seeks to represent our communities, our cities, our states have to be accountable.
But how do you, that sounds nice,
right.
But the reality is a couple of realities. Number one, in the last three elections, in the House of Representatives, Democrats got 5 million more votes than Republicans. In the Senate, Democrats got 20 million more votes than Republicans, and yet Republicans control both bodies, in the House because of gerrymandering, in the Senate because of small states that have been targeted by these white racist messages that didn't start with Ronald Reagan, but it really went on steroids when Reagan's first speech of his first campaign for president in 1980, his first speech coming out of that nominating convention was in Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Yeah.
I mean, about states' rights. And
exactly.
and all the people in the South went, he's my guy.
We understand what that means.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's not even
talked about by historians.
Well, one, I think the U.S. Senate is useless as an institution. It is one of the most undemocratic bodies of governments anywhere in the world today.
Yeah.
As you point out, you've got little tiny states like Wyoming with populations of 150,000 or more than that.
I think it's like 800,000 or 900,000.
That still, under has the same representation in the U.S. Senate as California.
Right, with 38.
I mean, it just does not make any sense at all. So, you know, there's major reforms that are on the long-term agenda, but need to be part of our discussion as we talk about democratic reform. So I think, you know, finding ways we can do that and how you reach into all of these pockets around the country, particularly with young people. You know, I find it very helpful to have discussions with high school students and mm-hmm. college students,
yeah.
right, because they really are coming into their own, and they're the citizens of the next, you know, four decades, right? So you really got to reach there and begin to have these discussions, have that engagement, and that becomes the foundation on which then you can build institutions, build organizations, build the kind of vehicles that then become the means by which you try to get change.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that that's one of the reasons why it's so important that if you're going to see the movie Selma, take some young people with you.
Absolutely.
You know, it's absolutely. this is a moment of history that is not well described, but is brilliantly described in this movie.
Well, apparently, though, there was a school superintendent in Alabama who just banned students from going to see the movie.
Seriously?
Seriously. There was some complaint, supposedly, about the movie containing profanity, so therefore, but you know, it became an excuse for not engaging in Alabama history. But I wouldn't be surprised in a number of states you would see that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, it's Robert E. Lee Day in five states right now. That's
right.
Bizarre. That is bizarre. Dr. Clarence Lussane, author of The Black History of the White House, professor at American University, American.edu. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Great to have you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Check out Dr. Lussane's book. It's The Black History of the White House. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Your media support group for We the People. And doing the old talk radio thing. Maru in Hennepin, yeah. Oklahoma. Hey, Maru. What's on your mind today?
How you doing?
Good. Good. What's up?
Oh, not too much. I was just sitting here listening to about Martin Luther King holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 63 years old. And about 25 years ago, a fellow made a statement to me. And I would never forget this statement. He made a statement that Martin Luther King was a troublemaker.
Hmm.
And I said, why? He said, because it wasn't time yet. I said, time yet? Is there a time limit on when a person should be treated like as a human being?
Really?
Is there a time limit when a person should be treated with respect? He got quiet. Is there a time limit when a person should have the same rights as every other human being? He got quiet and couldn't say anything else.
Was your friend black or white?
He wasn't a friend of mine. He's just white.
Okay.
He was a work associate.
So, okay. So this white guy says it's not time yet for African. Yeah.
Right.
Wow. Well, that sentiment was widespread in the white community. Yeah. You know.
And, right. Right. And I was just wondering. You know. I mean, there shouldn't be a time limit on it.
You're right. The first of all, the original sin never should have been committed. And then secondly, when, you know, at least in theory, I mean, this was the theory of the radical Republicans in the 1870s when the Civil War was over and slavery was officially ended, that should have been the end of it. We should have just, you know, that's it. But instead, you know, the Supreme Court in Plessy versus Ferguson brings us separate but equal and institutionalizes racial segregation in the United States and the Jim Crow laws and the KKK and Birth of a Nation comes along in 1915, I think it was, and becomes this giant recruiting thing for the Klan, and on, you know, it's off to the races. But Maru, thank you for calling and sharing the story. That's a great story, or kind of a sad story, actually, but, you know, I get it. Thank you very much. Gary in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Gary.
Tom, this is a pleasure to be able to talk to you.
My dad was a racist. I grew up in Michigan, and we live out here in Washington. And about a year ago, I was in Albertson, and I was buying coffee, and there was a black woman, probably in her mid-30s, with her teenage son with her. And I overheard her say that she could buy the same product, coffee product, in Walmart for a couple dollars less. And I couldn't let that go. I turned around to her and I said, do you realize that, you know, Martin Luther King not only died fighting for your rights, he died for economic equality. You have to understand that labor, this is a union grocery store, Albertson. You have to understand that Martin Luther King, that labor walked with Martin Luther King.
Yep.
And when you go into Walmart, you are going against the principles that Martin Luther King talked about, fought about, and died for. And I think she was sort of shocked that a white guy, I'm 58, I'm a geophysicist, I'm part of the 1%, and to say that to her, and I almost felt that maybe she wasn't that educated about Martin Luther King, but I feel this is very important. I feel this is a very important holiday, and I think the leadership, especially in Washington, need to address economic inequality and the institutional racism that is just widespread throughout this country.
Yeah, yeah. Very well said. Very well said. Gary, thank you for the call. Tom in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Tom.
Tom, what was Dr. King's view towards the contribution of organized labor to the civil rights movement?
I'm not a Martin Luther King scholar, but what little I do know is that the relationship was complicated in as much as at the same time he was trying to, he died trying to help unionize sanitation workers, garbage collectors. At the same time that he was working with unions, and there were a number of unions that openly supported Martin Luther King and what he was doing, there were other unions that were white-only unions, basically, that were keeping African Americans out of the workplace. And so, I've never read a really good scholarly piece on that dance that he had to do, but I'm guessing it was fairly complex.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Billy in Wimberley, Texas. Hey, Billy.
How you doing, Tom? Listen, the problem that I've got with Martin Luther King Day is not with celebrating the life and the heroic actions of Martin Luther King. It's with the fact that the left has hijacked Martin Luther King's message.
Really? I just got a Twitter from Fox News saying we celebrate Martin Luther King.
What? I'm not sure I understand what you mean. What does that mean?
Well, I don't think Fox News is the left.
Well, I mean, and I just told you that so do I. I admire the man and what he went through. But the point is that you folks are taking it and saying, okay, now we got to, it's civil rights for us to have what you call a living wage. It's civil rights for us to take from the rich and give to the poor. It's
That's
civil
correct.
Rights for women to be able to abort their babies for whatever reason they want to. It's civil rights for us to be alleviated from having guns in our society because people get shot. You're using the ideal of civil rights to promote other Marxist ideals.
Billy, these were not issues. The abortion and guns were not issues, to the best of my knowledge, that Dr. King spoke on. What he did speak very eloquently about was that all work has dignity, and anybody who works in the United States who keeps their nose to the grindstone, keeps their nose clean, and works a 40-hour week should be able to raise a family and buy a house. Number
the other
one.
Thing you talk about
and number two,
is code words.
No, and number two, he said that we needed to become a society where, regardless of your race, you had similar opportunity, and that starts at birth or even before birth. Even prenatal care among African Americans is below what it is for white Americans in the United States right now. Although, you know, to some extent, with the Medicaid expansion, you know, Obamacare may be addressing that. And number three, he was opposed to war. Now, if you think that those are left-right issues, that's real unfortunate. But you know, it's to some extent, it's true. You're right. The Republicans do not want everybody in America to be able to raise a family, even if they work a 40 or 50 or 60 or 70 hour a week. The Republicans don't want that. The Republicans do not want the top 1/100th of 1% to pay any more in taxes. They don't want the banksters to have to pay the security exchange tax that is being proposed right now. That the banksters were paying, by the way, from 1935 to 1964, so that money can be used to provide a tax credit for families, for people, for poor working families. They don't want that. I get it. The Republicans don't want that. They consider that socialism. They consider that redistribution of wealth. If you agree with that, fine. You're entitled to your opinion. That is not, in my opinion, the American way. But Martin Luther King believed that all work should have dignity, that all people should have rights, and that war, unless it's a purely defensive war, was wrong. And, I stand with him on that. And if that makes me a lefty, I'm proud of it. And if you oppose those three things and that makes you a right winger, you have my sympathy. Rafiq in Humble, Texas. Hey, Rafiq, what's up?
Yes, good afternoon, Tom. And I appreciate the work that you've been doing.
Thank you.
I'm also a supporter for the Sanders-Warren ticket.
Oh, great.
And in fact, my generation will be
there. We go.
Looking to travel the nation in support of that. We've redefined ourselves as the post-civil rights generation. So in speaking to your question about what can we do to honor Dr. King's legacy, one of the first things that I saw the necessity of is defining or redefining ourselves out of the same paradigm or mindset that helped to perpetuate racism. And of course it is a bit more extensive than I can speak about over the phone, but the fact that we recognize that when they use the name Generation X, we know that X represents the unknown. And because we were born, those of us who was born in 1964, 65, it's consistent with how the baby boomer generation were labeled, that they were labeled that because of that great event that happened during that course of American history.
Right after World War II, all the men came back and all the babies got born.
Right. So the next landmark step in or epoch in American history was the 1964-65 Civil Rights Bill.
Yeah.
So I redefined that and said that, well, that's who we are. That's who we should be, the post-Civil Rights generation, not Generation X.
Right. Except that it seems to me like the Republican Party and the Supreme Court are hell-bent for leather to reverse that. But excellent points, Rafiq. Thank you for calling. Thank you for making them. And thanks for being an activist member of your generation. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And by the way, my new book, Death in the Pines, which is a novel, is just out. Check it out. And welcome back. John in Pensacola, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
I just thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention that we're still, you know, as far as equality and civil rights, there's still a segment that's still separate but equal, and that's the disability rights movement. You know, it's something that I'm sure Dr. King spoke about a little bit, but, you know, it's, you know, and Reagan got us out of institutions, and that's great, but, you know, we're still, just because we're, you know, in the society, we're not seeing this part of it, or as far as vital, you know, we don't have a good voting bloc, so that we seem to get lumped in with the Medicaid and Medicare crowd every 4 to 8 years, and we have different different, somewhat the same issues, different issues as well.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think, John,
that the disability rights movement and arguably the gay rights movement of today, really of the last 20 years or so, would not have the structure, the strategy, or the vitality that they have if it weren't because of Martin Luther King?
Oh, totally. I agree with that.
Yeah. Okay. So, your point is well made, and we need to focus on everybody's civil rights. Absolutely everybody's. Thank you, John. Keith in Landrum, South Carolina. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Love your talk about the Ebenezer Baptist Church speech of menial wages. It reminds me of a story I learned in business school in the late 80s, and it was called Who is Your Customer? And it has nothing to do with money, but rather, who is your person that's downline from you? They can't do their job unless you do yours.
Right.
And it goes all the way down to the janitor. The CEO can't finish his job if the toilet paper roll is empty.
Yep.
So that makes a janitor's job just as important as the CEO. And when you look at it, the most person that's missed when they go on vacation is the janitor.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we are, as a society, we are collaborative and cooperative, much like, all the organs in your body. You wouldn't, the body wouldn't say, I don't think that I'm going to pay any attention to the liver today, or we'll just shut down the kidneys and see how everything goes. It's like everything is important, right down, you lose one toe and you can't walk well and you can't run worth a damn. I mean, it's just everything fits together, and it's the same with all the people in an organization. And
and while you're at it, remind the audience again about the story of the honeymooners. Just, Ralph was the sewer worker
Ralph was a bus driver. His buddy was the who Art Carney played was the sewer worker. Yeah,
that's right.
Al Norton. Norton was his name. Ed Norton. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. And that was a third floor Coldwater walk up. The people living simply, but living okay in New York City back in the day. And then the 70s and 80s came. I would say it was really the 80s when television started. Dallas and all this stuff, when television started displaying, rather than showing normal people with normal lives like Lucy and Desi, or Ralph and what was his wife, Alice, to the moon, Alice. Rather than showing normal people in normal situations, they started showing rich people, and then it was off to the races. Keith, thanks for the call. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. We're talking about the legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and not just, well, actually, I think that, the legacy is great. The movie Selma, by the way, you must go see. If you didn't hear my opening rant back an hour and a half ago, this is just an amazing movie. And I realize there are some LBJ apologists / historians who, and I've read Maureen Dowd's column in the New York Times, who take issue with the movie. I did not think the movie treated LBJ poorly at all. LBJ was a very coarse guy, and he was a politician. And, he was dancing this dance with Martin Luther King, and the results were very positive. So go see the movie. Go see the movie. George in Chicago. Hey, George, what's on your mind? George? Listening to WCPT?
Hello,
hey, George, what's up?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're on the air. Can you hear me?
Okay, I'm sorry. We kind of lost each other in the ether there.
Uh-huh.
I hope that nobody will misinterpret what I'm about to say as any criticism of the integrity and courage of the people and the poor people's movement, but I think it's historically inaccurate to say that they were the first Occupy movement. Washington, D.C. was occupied by the bonus marchers during the Hoover administration.
You're right.
And Walter Reuther and the United Auto Workers staged sit-down strikes in the Ford River Rouge plant in the 30s, occupied it for weeks at a time. And I'm sure there's other historical examples. Like
Ludlow, Colorado in the 1860s or 1870s.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I just thought I'd point that out.
Yeah. Good point, George. Martin Luther King took tactics that had been used for a long, long time. I mean, you could, he would, I think, argue, well, I don't want to even try to speak for Martin Luther King, but arguably Jesus was the first Occupy movement. You know, we're going to show up and we're going to practice nonviolence, even if it means being nailed to a cross. George, thank you for the call. Audrey in Richton Park, Illinois. Hey, Audrey.
Good afternoon, Tom. Keeping the discussion about the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I think part of the discussion when you were talking about the institutionalizing of disenfranchisement and marginalization and discrimination that continues on, and one of your guests was talking about how we are perceived, African Americans are perceived still today. And I think part of the problem is that regarding the ignorance of history and culture, in this fight for equality, people forget part of it is that we're perceived as something less than human, that we are still perceived by too many people as the N-word. And that now you have so much ignorance regarding the history of that word and the history of the civil rights movement, you know, that, you know, basically our equal rights are based on our equality in humanity. We are all human beings. But we've had, like, our music basically poisoned over the last 25 years by people who are paid rather well, entertainers in the music industry who are paid rather well to sell us out. That's what I call them, sellouts. Because they sell the word N-word and the B-word for our women. They've indoctrinated self-denigration among our people. And so we have an entire generation or two that actually believes, hey, there's nothing like that word. And that word is even to be embraced, even to the point of being used as some sort of term of endearment, you know, the greeting, what's up, my N-word.
Yeah.
And that's not the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He wanted, the basis was that we are all equal, that we are all God's children, we are all God's creation, human beings equal to one another, that we should be judged on the content of our character, not the color of our skin, and that the color of our skin should not be used as an excuse to call us something less than human. And that's what that N-word is. That's what it was for, to say, hey, it's okay to enslave them. It's okay to abuse them. It's okay to disenfranchise them. It's okay to segregate them. All kinds of hideous, inhumane acts can be done. It's okay because they're nothing but that N-word.
Well, and if I can expand that a little bit, what you're describing is something, is a process called objectification, turning a person from a human into an object, and it's something that societies and cultures do, and they do it typically in times of war. During World War II, it was not just popular culture, but it was literally in the headlines of the New York Times, referring to Japanese and referring to Germans with ethnic slurs, and to objectify them, to justify killing people, you know, oh, they're not quite human. You know, what Hitler did was objectify the gypsies, the gays, the Jews, and use the N-word is like objectification on steroids. Am I making sense?
What they did, yes, because what they did is they said, this is what makes slavery of these people, you know, because we weren't enslaved as a result of war.
Right.
It was enslavement as, you know, okay, we need people to do this work and we need them to be as cheap as possible. And the thing is, a lot of bigots today don't realize that by cheapening any one group's human worth, such greedy people could thereby cheapen the cost of all human labor. And it's a concept that goes on today, except that somehow or another, like I said, because of the ignorance of our people's history and culture, there are people who don't realize the horrible value that word has in betraying us instead of continuing the movement forward.
I'm with you. Audrey, a brilliant analysis. Thank you for the call. Thank you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Best of my knowledge, no, it's a corporation. Corporations are not people. Oh, I'm tangled in my wires. Corporations are not people, my friends.
He's going to run again. Mitt Romney, can you believe this?
Actually, I'm hopeful. And he starts out by talking about poverty. Isn't that sweet? Yeah. So, anyhow, I just want to. We've been talking about Martin Luther King Day all day, and his legacy and what he's doing, and I want to continue that conversation. I also want to point out, and this is a piece that was written by Peter Dreyer and published over at truthout.org. He says, Ken Burns overlooks the secret of FDR's success, power to the people. FDR recognized that his ability to push progressive legislation through Congress depended on the pressure generated by protesters, workers, World War I veterans, that would be like the bonus army, the jobless, the homeless, and farmers, even though he did not always welcome working closely with those constituencies. And then, you know, the old apocryphal story, probably apocryphal. I agree with you, now go out and make me do it. And, you know, which is arguably what President Obama has said as well. So we need to get out there and we need to get active. I wanted to share a couple of other things with you today, though, and I mentioned some of them. You know, the world's richest are gathering right now in Davos, Switzerland. And if not right now, any day now. I think it started today, but it could be tomorrow. And it's sometime this week. The World Economic Forum. And Oxfam has released this report showing that in 2009, this was 6 years ago, the top 1% owned 44% of the world's wealth. In 2014, see, we're still living in an era of Reaganomics, Bushonomics. Right. It's still the tax code is skewed to the point where, you know, the Mitt Romney loophole, for example, is one of the ones, these five steps that President Obama is proposing economically. One of them is to close the Mitt Romney loophole. Mitt Romney had $21 million in an IRA. You cannot put $21 million into an IRA. But he can. You can do it if you're a multimillionaire. And it's tax deferred. Right. So he's not helping to pay for the roads and the schools and the, you know, everything else that he's using. So anyhow, the top 1%, they owned 44% of all the wealth in the world in 2009. It went up to 48% in 2014. And right now it is 50%. The top 1% own half the wealth in the world. The bottom 80% own 5% of the wealth in the world. 1/20. That's astonishing. It's just astonishing. Meanwhile, Senator Lindsey Graham is talking about maybe running for president. And I had to share this with you. This is Bob Ney, who, you know, shows up on this program regularly from the Talk Radio News Service. and is the author of an astonishing book about Washington, D.C., in which he lays out the crimes of John Boehner. It's called Sideswiped. And this is from former Congressman Bob Ney. He's the only guy who went to jail in Congress from the Jack Abramoff thing. And frankly, I think that a large part of the reason why he went to jail is because he was the guy, he spoke Farsi, the language that they speak in Iran. And he was the guy that the Swiss ambassador who represents the Iranians to the United States handed a letter to George W. Bush, gave it to Bob Ney because he speaks Farsi, saying, we will recognize Israel and we will stop our any kind of program to build nuclear weapons if you will give us full recognition. And Bob Ney tried to get that to George W. Bush. He got it to George W. Bush's people. And a few months later, Bob Ney found himself in prison. And I don't consider that to be a coincidence. And you can read his book and learn all about it. His book is called Sideswiped. But anyhow, on his webpage, on his Facebook page, he said, and I quote, Senator Lindsey Graham is a mini. Now, keep in mind, this is a guy who knows these people, right? He served in Congress. Senator Lindsey Graham is a mini-me John McCain puppet, pure and simple. If wannabe President Graham, yes, sugar daddy McCain announced Lindsey might be running, would tell the truth, this article would be palatable. Graham says he wants to help the Iran negotiations. This kills the Iran negotiations. He's talking about this legislation that Lindsey Graham and the other neocons in the Senate are pushing, and the House as well, that would strengthen the sanctions. In other words, blow up Obama's negotiation with Iran right now. Okay. This kills the Iran negotiations. Iran has not been contained, halted, reviewed, etc., involving its potential nuclear buildup for years. The stick approach has not stopped them, and unless someone is willing to massively bomb them, it will not be stopped. So the point remains that the current negotiations could produce a result that is good for the world, with Iran coming around on the issue, and the United States would be a significant part of this. This is the Obama negotiations, says former Republican Congressman Bob Ney. This may not work. We will know by the June deadline. So there's time for additional sanctions. But Graham wants to kill that chance because he and his daddy, John, have never seen a war they did not like. Graham is a bloodthirsty senator who loves to send someone's child to war. Since when does starting a war become the number one reason to be a president? Sorry, good Senator McCain. Graham has as much chance of being president as I do. Senator McCain, unpack your bags. You will not be living in the White House courtesy of Lindsey in 2017. Just saying. Bingo. And then Bob Ney posted another one. The Representative Jason Chaffetz is now the head of the House Oversight Committee. This was Darrell Issa's committee. He took down Darrell Issa's picture. Right. He's now explaining why he took down the picture. He's replaced it with pictures from American history and life, including the U.S. Postal Service, coal mining, and civil rights. It's a Republican, Jason Chaffetz. He says, I feel really strongly that in the committee room, we should be inspired by those we serve, not by previous committee chairmen. No more giant picture of Darrell Issa. Cool. Okay, this is what President Obama is proposing, and this is the kind of stuff that I think that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would endorse. Right now, the tax you pay if you work with your hands or your brain for a living in most professions and you make over $340,000, I think it is, your tax rate goes up to 39% on money after you've made your first $300,000 and change. Okay. It goes up to 39%. But if you work in a very narrow sliver of industries, principally banking and private equity, if you're Mitt Romney and you make your money by what's called capital gains, in other words, you make your money with money. Now, arguably, you're still using your brain, but you're making your money with money instead of by being a brain surgeon. Brain surgeons, they pay 39% income tax. Banksters, they pay 20%. It's now 25%. Obama wants to take that up to 28%, which is what Ronald Reagan had lowered it to. So that's a, you know, I think a very reasonable. He also wants to expand middle and low income family tax credits. He wants to give a break to people who are trying to put their kids through school. He wants to close the Mitt Romney loophole, and he wants to put a small 0.7% tax on banks when they borrow money, because that's risky business. Right? It's good stuff. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I want to share with you David Morris's 5 worst Republican lies about income inequality, and then we'll pick up our conversation. I'll take your calls. We'll continue talking about the movie Selma. Welcome back. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that, in speaking of Martin Luther King, his Christianity in action, his love in action, compassion in action, to me is probably the truest form of Christianity, and it challenges my own. And I think that to say that he's leftist, well, so be it. If you interpret that as being leftist, then the problem is in the kind of Christianity that we're all living out. Perhaps we need to reflect upon Martin Luther King's brand of it. And if he was really a leftist, he would have advocated violent overthrow of the government, a revolution. He would describe.
No, I don't think that's unique to left or right. That's reactionary. But I agree with you. I love the old bumper sticker. Jesus was the first liberal.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's like, well, I'm really reflecting on what somebody else had said, and also on what was said last week about people calling in and the idea of cutting somebody who is only making $1,000 a month on disability, to me, that, as I said last week, that's antichrist. I think you can say that, and not because I'm a leftist, but because I'm a Christian, and I think a lot of other Christians would agree with me, and I look toward Martin Luther King as a template or somebody to emulate in my own, Christianity. I think that he could have stayed home and been a pastor and had a nice middle class life and even done quite a bit of good, but he didn't do that. He sacrificed himself and by passive resistance and taking on power and doing something really wonderful for all of us, really.
Yeah.
It's bad that he was assassinated. This country would be so much different. We might not even really be having this conversation, or I wouldn't be so worked up about.
Yeah. Oh, and Jack and Bobby. But here's the you mentioned the Antichrist, and the Republicans, by saying that they want to cut, the first thing that they did is set up a 20% cut for Social Security and disability insurance payments. And I would submit to you that it is not beyond the realm of possibility, if you take a relatively fundamentalist Christian view of the world, that around the time that the Republican Party flipped the stars on their logo upside down, so they now have the satanic stars on the GOP logo rather than the American flag stars, it's an upside down 5-pointed star, the pentagram, that at that point in time, which coincided with George W. Bush running for president of the United States and becoming president, that at that point in time, arguably, the Republican Party was taken over by Satan.
You could make a point. I agree with you. I wanted to say also, they adopt the language of business. They adopt the language of capitalism. This is not Christianity. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The economy is meant to serve us. It's a Greek word, and it means that in a very small sense, our home economy.
Right. And see Jesus with regard to needles and camels. Thank you, John. Thank you very much for the call. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. So if the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was doing God's work, And, I mean, to the point where when he died what's called intestate, without a will. And he had made, for the time, you know, a fair amount of money giving speeches and writing articles and things. And he gave all that money to the movement. He basically left his family penniless, and which has caused some problems for the family over the years. But he did that out of a sense of moral duty. He was honoring Mahatma Gandhi's basically vow of poverty. So here you have, you know, if you want to put this in a religious frame, and we just had a caller a little bit ago saying that when the Republicans, as their first order of business, set up the possibility, the probability of up to a 20% cut in Social Security disability benefits, cutting benefits to people who are paralyzed, who are on ventilators, who are suffering from PTSD, who are orphans, who are, you know, that was the first thing the Republicans did. Change the House rules so that Social Security disability would have to be cut. And the caller said that is anti-Christian, that is the Antichrist. And I said, and I say, you know, if you want to look at it from that point of view, you look at read Matthew 25. The disciples came to Jesus and said, how do we get to heaven? It's the only place in the Bible where they actually ask him that question. How do we get to hang out with you in the afterlife? And Jesus says, in the end days, I'm going to be sitting here on my throne sorting the sheep from the goats, right? In other words, the people who go to heaven from the people who are going to hell. And he says, and I will say to the sheep, when I was thirsty, you gave me water. When I was hungry, you gave me food. When I was naked, you gave me clothing. When I was, or the modern equivalent would be homeless, you gave me shelter. When I was sick, you healed me. When I was in prison, you visited me. And I will say to the goats, when I was thirsty, you did not give me water. When I was hungry, you did not give me food. When I was, and it goes through the list, and he says to the goats, you go off to eternal damnation. And to the sheep, he's saying, come on along with me. And at that point in the story, and it's really useful to read this story in the Bible if you're at all inclined to this kind of thing. At that point in the story, the disciples freak out. And one of them, I forget which one, says to, I think it was John, says to Jesus, you know, basically, we're screwed. We're not going to go to heaven because we've never seen you thirsty. We've never seen you hungry. We've never seen you sick. We've never seen you naked. We've never seen you in prison. And so we haven't been able to have an opportunity to do the things that you just said. What do we do? And Jesus said, as you do it unto the least of these among you, you have done it unto me. Now, I'm paraphrasing from memory, but I think it's pretty close. That's the essence of Christianity. And what the Republicans are doing by the first thing they do, cutting money to disabled people. Now they want to cut food stamps, which is mostly going to children. Half, they want to cut money for education. Half of the children in America going to school right now are living below the poverty line. The Republicans want to do it, you know, they want to undo Obamacare so that poor people no longer have free or inexpensive health care, the working poor in particular. You've got Republican governors who are blocking the expansion of Medicaid in their states. That doesn't seem Christian to me. In fact, it seems to me the opposite. And I'm just wondering out loud, do you think it's possible that around 2000, when George W. Bush was running for president, the guy responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, the guy who gleefully executed hundreds of prisoners in Texas, joked about executing Carl F.A. Tucker to cut poor Tucker Carlson in a way that horrified him, said it was totally creepy. About the time that George W. Bush was running for president, the Republican Party flipped the stars upside down on their logo and turned them from the five-pointed American flag star to the upside-down five-pointed star called a pentagram, which is the official symbol of Satan worshipers. Is it possible that around that time, the Republican Party was taken over by Satan? What do you think? If Martin Luther King Jr. was doing God's work, whose work is the modern-day Republican Party doing? whose work is being done by the guys who are calling for more war, more bombs in the Middle East? Whose work is being done by the people who are saying, sick people, let them die? Remember that moment in the debate when Ron Paul was asked that question? Whose work are they doing? Whose work are they doing when they say, oh, some people can vote if their skin is white, other people can't vote if their skin is black? Whose work are they doing when they take these positions that are, you know, fundamentally destroying the fabric of the American middle class? Whose work are they doing when they send good union wage jobs to countries that practice slave labor or something damn close to it, and kill their people who speak up about it? Whose work are they doing? Is it Jesus's work? Whose work are they doing when they push for the death penalty? Whose work are they doing when they say that people who poison other people, who pollute and contaminate communities with the effluent from their paper mills and their refineries, should have fewer regulations, which is going to mean more people are going to get sick and die? Whose work are they doing? Jesus or Satan? Something worth thinking of. 28 minutes past the hour. We'll pick up your phone calls after this. You don't have to answer that question. Although it would be interesting. That maybe should be probably for another day, because today I really want to focus on Martin Luther King Jr., the holiday, and this movie Selma, which is just an absolutely amazing movie about movement politics. You must see it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So if you haven't seen the movie Selma, make plans to see it tonight or this afternoon or whatever, as soon as you can, and take as many young people with you as you can. It's your media support group for We the People, a Tom Hartman program occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And Danielle said, after I wondered out loud, you know, has the Republican Party been taken over by Satan? A number of people called up, screamed obscenities at her, and hung up. You know, if you're a Republican and you think that the Republican Party has not been taken over by Satan, give me a call. You know, let's talk on the air. You don't have to just scream at you know, the poor person who answers the phone. Scream at me. I'll put you on the air. As long as you keep it, you know, legal. Bob in Sherman Oaks, California. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hi. Tom, I've been a serious pacifist since probably my teenage years. I was at the Martin Luther King March listening to his speech, which, by the way, came at the end of a lot of really, really boring speeches on a really hot day, and was about to leave when his voice came over the speakers as I was leaving. And
you're talking about the march in D.C.?
It was one of the most transformative speeches, most transformative moments of my entire life. I mean, about the same feeling I got when I heard Billie Holiday come back from almost the dead and sing her song. It was an amazing moment. But what's really important is I discovered in myself a serious fault that I think we all perhaps need to look into. And that's when I went to a school run by the Ethical Culture Society. I don't know if you know who they are. They joined with Mark Twain back in 1898 and stuff, and were fighting for pacifist ideals and against the war on Spain, which was really the war on Cuba to start with. And we had, of course, a black person working for us. I'm a Jewish. My father was a doctor, very typical, fairly wealthy. And yet one of my closest friends was black, and he was downstairs in our pool room. And yet I'd gotten a little angry about something that the person working for us had done, and I went downstairs and found myself using the N-word. Jokingly, I thought, until I realized there's my closest friend with black skin, and in me without realizing, and buried in probably a great deal of us who don't acknowledge it, was this sarcastic but based, but somehow being white in America and not having prejudice is something we really have to look into our hearts and see if some of that doesn't really exist. I just thought I'd share that anecdote because I've never gotten over it, and I'm 76 years, that I actually said that to a close friend who was black. You know, that expression, we all have friends, some of them are black, and yet here I did, and I don't think he ever got over what I said. We would have parties on Park Avenue and places like that. 50% of the population was rich, 50% of the population poor, so we all dressed poor so nobody would feel bad. But he would never join us at our parties because, of course, the only people chaperoning us in the 50s would be a maid in a uniform and black standing there. And we didn't understand it, but, of course, that was a symbol of what black people were going through that we just chose not to acknowledge. Yeah. Anyhow, I thought that was perfect. I did want to add one thing about pacifism. Mm-hmm. I believe that the most interesting thing that Jesus said, and I used to argue with the Friends people, the American Friends, was that I believe in universal cowardice. Unfortunately, universal love has become a really hard thing, but I always like to quote the fact that when they came for Jesus, instead of saying, "Thou shalt not kill," what he said to Peter when he pulled out his sword was, "Peter, put thy sword away. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword." So as a pacifist, I believe in universal cowardice as being a great stepping stone. Unfortunately, we've seen in India and Gandhi, and we see even here in America, pacifism is often a great tool to win a victory, but it often turns back to violence, as we see in India, which is now a nuclear country. Yeah. And that's all I have for today.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. That's an extraordinary story. And I think that we are all in some deep level, we are all racist, maybe too strong a word, but certainly racially conscious in ways that we would be embarrassed by or ashamed of. And by we, I suspect I'm talking for the entire human race, although maybe there is some saint among us, and maybe Martin Luther King Jr. was one of them. Bob, thank you for the call. Jesse in Miami. Hey, Jesse, what's on your mind today?
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, I think, just real quick, the Republicans are guided by the religion of survival of the fittest. And the only way us 99% is going to get over it, Mr. Obama is going to leave a legacy, hopefully better than his foreign policy, is that what he said last week. He's going to want to tax the rich. Mm-hmm. But if he taxed the rich, it's still taxing the unsustainable system. We cannot cover the world with concrete. So hopefully Mrs. Warren and Mr. Bernie Sanders pick up the legacy of, let's get a sustainable system, and we could do it with using Thomas Paine common sense. I don't like that word populism, just common sense. Take back the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. Okay. Jesse, thank you for the call. Chris in Minocqua, Wisconsin. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Yep. Hi.
Chris, you there?
Yeah, I hear you. How are you doing?
I'm fine. What's on your mind?
Oh, I was just listening to your show. You had been talking about the poor.
Chris, you're fading out. Chris, for some reason, I can't hear you. But I can tell you that Chris has vanished. When Danielle wrote down what Chris was calling about, she said that Chris said that the Bible says, you know, you're supposed to heal the sick and care for the poor and that sort of thing, but it doesn't say the government should. And actually, the first five, the second sentence, let me just read this to you. This is the second sentence. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people from one another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world, for I was hungry and you gave me something to eat, I was thirsty, etc. Right? You heard this all from me before. It starts out, though, all the nations will be gathered before him. So if you're going to use a biblical argument to try to take a position on whether or not government should tax the rich to provide food, shelter, and medicine for the poor, it's very clear, and you can read dozens of different translations, that Jesus was speaking of the nations, not the individuals, the nations. And within those nations, the individuals would be judged. So as a nation, in my interpretation of this, we have that obligation. Let's see here. Dan in Simpsonville, South Carolina. Hey, Dan, you don't think the Republicans have been taken over by Satan?
No, you almost sound like Rush Limbaugh making that kind of analogy, the ludicrousy of it. But my point is...
What's your evidence that I'm wrong?
Well...
I can provide you with evidence that I'm right.
Well, I can provide you with evidence that you're wrong.
Okay, please do.
When you look at any survey about who donates more money, people on the left or people on the right, it's 2 to 3 times as much people on the right versus people on the left. That's just on
That's
the
because
survey.
People on the right have more money, Dan. And if you flip that survey upside down, what you find is that the proportion of income that people donate who are poor is massively greater than the proportion of income that people donate who are rich. So
yeah,
while the total dollars given by rich Republicans might be more than the total dollars given by working class or poor Democrats, the percentage of their income is a larger percentage of their income is given by poor Democrats than by rich Republicans. Number
well, I
one.
Mean, that's a nice spin. I think you.
No,
it's true. You do that extremely
it's a fact.
Well, and that's why I love watching, listen to your show, because of how you sell your position. But you don't have the only position, is all I'm saying. You know, they do talk about...
I know that.
...who also talks about not being boastful.
Right. Yep.
Not being boastful.
I am not saying that I am the world's greatest Christian, Dan. I'm a lousy Christian.
No, but what you're saying is the Democrats, because they give more money...
No, I never mentioned money. I said they heal people, they feed people, they clothe and house people. They do what Jesus said the nations should do in Matthew 25. Therefore, their behavior is more consistent with Christianity. And the Republicans who say, no, we shouldn't do any of those things, their behavior is anti-Christianity. That is the Antichrist. That's Satan.
Any is where you go wrong. Because, and this is a typical argument when politicians and political folks like you that are good at it, it's always black or white, any or none. It's not, they want to do it more, they want to do it less.
Dan, you're right. Dan, you're right. There are, no doubt, a lot of good Republicans. And you know, Republicans that Jesus would probably like. I'm just saying that as an institution, these two parties are taking two very different positions that are consistent with and inconsistent with Christianity.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And yeah, and then the Republicans had the balls to put the five-pointed star upside down. Courage is the wrong word. Temerity. That's the word I was looking for. Oh, my. Michael, in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, how you doing? Thanks for watching Free Speech.
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Okay, first, I'm not a scholar on Martin Luther King, so I'm really not going to address that issue, but he was a great man. But since you brought up Davos, Switzerland, wondering if you could find out for us regular people how many of the people going to Davos, Switzerland arrived on their private jets and how many took public airways. What do you think? Thanks, Doug.
I would guess the vast majority arrived on private jets. We're not talking about the 1% here, Michael. That's people who earn over $300,000 a year. We're talking about the 1/100th of 1%, the 1/10,000th of 1%. the really, truly, exactly. deeply, profoundly rich. And they don't travel on public transportation ever.
Yeah, they don't deal with us little people. No,
right.
no.
That's
exactly,
right.
yep.
That's right, yeah. So I think you nailed it. Thanks a lot for the call, Michael. Ed in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom, you know, the problem with this show is that the people are so darn smart, they take you off subject with all the interesting things they
can
do. But no, Robert E. Lee actually thought he was going to be hung. But
he did, really?
Of course, I mean, he expected it.
Yeah.
You know, but he was wanting his men taken care of. He was a good man. But no, I want to ask you a question, a hypothetical. Should you think President Obama, as he turns the helm of the ship of state of ours over to President-elect Bernie Sanders, should he say, I am going right now with my wife and my daughters to The Hague to turn myself in for crimes against humanity because I used drones to kill and innocent people died, and I would like to set a precedent that all leaders of all countries will do the same thing when they leave office?
Yeah.
And go to The Hague. And
I would not call for
that,
Ed, but I think that President Obama, I believe that he's a decent man deep down inside and that this probably tortures him. I hope I'm right. I hope that he has that moral compass, that moral center. I believe he does. I might be wrong. I mean, I've talk to people in this town who will tell you that basically every president and most senators and members of the House of Representatives are sociopaths. That's what it takes to get to that level of power in any political system other than maybe a lottery political system, which, by the way, is what the Greeks used to do and to avoid the sociopaths. And I don't subscribe to that. I think that there's a lot of good people who are in office who are not crazies, and I think Obama's one of them, but I disagree with him on his drone policy. I think it is hurting the United States. But I don't know. I don't think he should turn himself into The Hague.
Hey, Tom, the star is swinging upside down on the Republican flag.
Yeah.
That happened the day that George Bush named Dick Cheney as his vice president. I'm pretty sure. I'm a registered Republican. I was paying attention during that election period.
Well, that's interesting.
It happened as soon as Dick Cheney's name was mentioned.
So then Dick Cheney is the Antichrist. Now it's all starting to make sense. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour. And Ed just called and said that he's a registered Republican and that the stars got flipped upside down on the GOP logo the day that Dick Cheney, that George Bush announced that Dick Cheney was going to be his vice president. So now I'm confronted with another question. Is Dick Cheney the Antichrist? I don't know. It's, you know, I'm saying all of this more in jest than seriously. I mean, I personally have a problem with the whole idea of Satan, much less his or its taking over a political party. Although I do believe that there is evil in this world, I'm not sure. I don't pretend to understand the depths or dimensions of it. But enough said. We'll just pick up your calls here. Mark in Chicago. Hey, Mark, what's up?
You know that John Paul II, the Pope, he said to him, believe that George Bush was the Antichrist. Anyway.
I beg your pardon?
Pope John Paul II is said to have believed that he said to have believed that George Bush was the Antichrist.
Really? Where'd you get that from?
Yeah. Well, that was, I don't remember where I heard it. Some radio program, either public radio or some such thing, said that. He had a horror fascination with George Bush.
Yeah, I met Pope John Paul II. Shook his hand. He's an amazing guy. But I had no idea. I mean, I met him before Bush was president. I met him in, I think, '98. But Anyhow, you wanted to talk about Martin Luther King?
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to say that I think he showed his greatness when he talked about class and not only race. And I think that's, you know, that gives him a universality, which is characteristic of great persons. I think that like today, a lot of black scholars and black intellectuals are saying that class is becoming the new race. And I think, you know, that shows that Martin Luther King was relevant not only to his own period, but he had a universal relevance to any period.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And I think class has always been the new race. I think that this is an old thing. I'm with you, Mark. Thank you. James in Las Vegas, you disagree with me?
Absolutely. Let me preface this with, I am right of left and left of right. I don't describe either party wholeheartedly, but let's go with your quote, what you do to the least of me, you do unto me. On the liberal side of life, they're more about women's rights and your right to abortion. That's killing a small child. That is murder.
James, respectfully, I don't think that most, first of all, well over 90% of abortions happen in the first 3 months. And the few that happen after those first 3 months, the vast majority of them are happening because the life of the mother is at risk, or because
let me just let you know, we had a guy here in Vegas that was doing late term abortions and giggling about cutting little kids' spines,
and he's gone to jail.
All that stuff. He's gone to jail,
right? As he should.
Also want to.
That is killing children. That's a whole different thing than safe legal abortions. But I'm not suggesting, James, that abortion is biblical or anti-biblical. I have not injected abortion. I don't see anything about abortion in Matthew 25. Arguably, in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus said, you know, whoever violates a child, it would be better if they had a rope hung around their neck with a stone on it and they were thrown into the sea. You know, you could argue that, you know, somebody who is if you believe that a late term abortion, aborting a viable baby, is murder. And I think you could build a case for that.
We get into semantics again about what's life, what's not life. I subscribe to, as soon as it happens, that's life. Now, the second part of the thing here, debt free is also a biblical principle. And we spend absorbent amounts of money taking care of people. Yes, we should. Yes, he says, take care of the widows and the orphans and all that stuff there. And I get it. But we're also taking ourselves so deep into a level of debt.
Well, this is a direct consequence of Reaganomics, James. Ronald Reagan cut the top tax rate from 74% down to 28%. You know, this is the natural consequence of this. See Kansas and Sam Brownback. It used to be when Dwight Eisenhower was president, corporations paid over 30% of the total cost of running our federal government. Today, it's less than 10%. I mean, these are the direct consequences of Republican economic policies. You can't talk to me about debt. I'm sorry. It is not Democratic policies that produce debt. It's Republican policies. A and B, the debt you have to worry about is not the federal debt. It's our trade deficit and it's corporate debt. And corporate debt in this country is over $50 trillion. Nancy, just a minute to the break. I got a quick one here. Nancy, in Fruitland Park, Florida? Yes.
Hello. Yeah, can you hear me? Yeah, I'll make it quick. I got all your books. I'm going to read them, I promise.
Thank you.
They're wonderful. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I wanted to just mention about the fact that I think when we honor Martin Luther King and all that, I wanted to make sure that I mentioned about the disabled among us, the fact that how it relates to corporations, the fact that I can go into wherever you want to say, and I'm sure you can pick one right away, and I can get something, and I literally have to take pliers and try to get a package open. I mean, you know, and the way they package stuff is even against, I mean, they marginalize the disabled and the poor among us.
Supposedly anti-theft packaging.
Right. And it, you know, it's just, there's just so much that, you know, is in that that way that, you know, and it's just so frustrating. Oh, well, you can take it back. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I don't have, you know, there's only 24 hours in a day.
Yeah, there you go. Nancy, thanks for the call. And it's the end of the day. It's the end of the show. Holy cow. I was ready for another hour. Thank you so much for being with us today. Get out to see the movie Selma. It is really worth whatever it costs. It is. This is one of those once-in-a-generation movies. It's an amazing movie. Get out to see Selma. We'll continue the conversation tomorrow. And, of course, I got a whole pile of stuff I never even got to that we'll get to tomorrow. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.